Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. Everyone's heard of the artist John James Audubon. They know he has something to do with birds at the very least, and often consider him the father of ornithology, the study of birds, in the U.S. But it wasn't started by Audubon. It was a Scot who brought the study of American birds to prominence in Europe 200 years ago. That was Alexander Wilson. Joining us is the co-author of a new book on his life. It's called Alexander Wilson, the Scot Who Founded American Ornithology. Ohio Wesleyan University zoology professor Edward Burt Jr. And welcome to the show. You're called Jed, so I'll say welcome to the show, Jed.
Thank you very much, Anne.
Before Wilson, the study of birds in North America wasn't considered such a big deal. Europeans didn't think much of American birds. Why was that?
Well, keep in mind this was in the late 18th century, and ornithology as such was limited to just a few museums in Europe. So there really was nothing in the United States, a few explorers, very few people, such as William Bartram, and you can add one more skill to Thomas Jefferson's resume. He published the first state bird list in his notes on the state of Virginia. So they were really the only people.
And no surprise, then, there was a connection between Alexander Wilson and both of these people. He lived very near Bartram, and he corresponded with Jefferson.
Yes, quite by coincidence, he wound up landing when he came to this country near Philadelphia and eventually took a job teaching school at a schoolhouse founded by William Bartram's father. Jefferson was a hero of his, and he spoke out on the occasion of Jefferson's inaugurations. As a schoolteacher, he was a prominent figure in the community. He was asked to give a speech. In those days, you couldn't follow the inauguration by radio or TV, so you asked somebody prominent to speak about it. And the speech Wilson gave was circulated in the newspapers of the time up and down the Atlantic coast. And then Jefferson wrote to Wilson about birds.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is the co-author of a new book about the founding of American ornithology, the study of birds in the United States, Alexander Wilson. The name of the book is Alexander Wilson, the Scot Who Founded American Ornithology. Edward Burt Jr. is my guest. He's a zoology professor at Ohio Wesleyan University. They will be celebrating Alexander Wilson's life next month. For more information, you can go to a link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. Why did he move to America? He actually comes from pretty humble beginnings. He wasn't well educated, but he was lucky enough to be educated. Tell us about his early life.
Well, you're correct. He was born in Scotland on the 6th of July, 1766. He entered in Paisley, Scotland, and he entered the Paisley Latin Grammar School at age 5. His mother intended that he become a Presbyterian minister and hired a divinity student to tutor him. One expects that he probably was tutored using the King James Bible. James was the first Scot to ascend the throne of England. And so that Bible would presumably have been the one they would use, and that may be a key to Wilson's use of language throughout his life. However, his mother died when he was 10 years old, and the family moved from Paisley outside. His father remarried, and he remained very close to his father and stepmother throughout his life. But he became what I suppose we could call a cowboy. He was a boy, and he herded cows for about 3 years. Scotland had no fences or hedgerows, so if you wanted the cows to stay in the right place, you had to put somebody with them. Then he was an apprentice weaver. He became a journeyman weaver, went peddling, and it's during the time he was peddling that one expects he learned birds. We know from his letters written even at that time in a journal he started keeping as a teenager that he visited prominent places in Scotland. We know that he was poaching game on the nearby lord's estate for the family to eat. And that's probably where his marksmanship and his familiarity with birds came. But he then became a activist poet in the early labor movement. That got him into trouble with the law. And eventually, in order to stay out of jail, he decided to leave the country.
I was kind of fascinated by the story of what exactly got him in trouble with the law, because he wrote a poem about that really did not cloak the target, which was an employer, mm-hmm. and he blackmailed him, or tried to.
Yes, it's an odd story, because in court, Wilson admitted writing the poem and writing the letter, but denied delivering the letter or having anything to do with that. There were a couple of rather questionable characters associated with Wilson, and one wonders if they somehow managed to convince him to write the letter, and then they took it upon themselves to write it. Nothing ever happened. He was not convicted, and that actually was the problem, because the charges were let sleep, which then meant whenever he got in trouble, the sheriff simply locked him up. If there was any question about his saying something against the mill owners, he would just get locked up for a few days.
Because there was always something pending.
Right. There was always something pending. Nobody was taking action, probably because, according to several people who looked at it later, the charges were true. He was accusing the mill owners of cheating the weavers by using a yardstick that was 40 inches instead of 36. So, in fact, it looked as though they were weaving fewer yards than they were. Therefore, they had to be paid less. But he decided to leave the country. He did so. He came to the U.S. on a ship with his nephew. His nephew was very close to him and came with him. And he then took up teaching school.
When you decided to write this book with William Davis, did you know he was going to be such an interesting character?
Yes, basically. My familiarity with Wilson goes way back. I was a college freshman when my roommate gave me an old biography of Wilson, because I was going to be spending the summer on an island studying birds, and he felt I would need something to occupy my free time. So that was 40-some years ago. Much later, when I was a member of the Wilson Ornithological Society, which is just a professional society that one joins if you're studying birds, I thought, well, nobody has ever done a poster on Wilson. So I put together a poster for the meeting. I didn't have anything else to present that year. That went fine. That was the end of that. About 10 years later, I got a call from Harvard. They had been given a bequest of pictures drawn and painted by an artist who a person giving the gift claimed was Wilson. But there were no names or dates on the work, so they called me and asked if I would come and identify them. My response was, why are you calling me? I mean, this was just out of the blue. And they said, well, we talked to the president of the Wilson Society, and he said you were the expert.
Because you did a poster
because
on it.
Because I did a poster. Exactly.
Let that be a lesson to all of you out there working on posters with your kids. You never
right.
know.
Right. But on the other hand, I thought, well, why not? This would be fun. And they were going to pay for me to come. And both of the pieces of art are in the book. The painting is actually done by William Bartram, as far as I can
Again, this man
understand.
Who kind of got him interested in the naturalist
right, who,
movement.
Who was very important to Wilson. And the drawings were, in fact, Wilson's. They were paisley-designed little birds, beautifully done in colored ink, in student workbooks. And I think this was a case of Wilson, the teacher, was saying, this is a great piece of work. Well, you didn't have gold stars in those days. So he would spend his time in the evening drawing these little colored ink designs for the student's name was William Wood. And the kids would take it home. They certainly liked him as a teacher. They would bring him all sorts of things, mice and spiders. They knew he had a passion for natural history, so they would bring him things. And he had to actually start putting a slowdown on this. And say, you know, not.
What did
not
his
anymore.
Classrooms look? What did they look like? Zoos?
Probably. Not to mention his rented room. He kept lots of birds and animals in the course of studying them, and I feel as though William Jones, his landlord, deserves a real thank you for putting up with this.
You mentioned, I think, earlier that his hero was Thomas Jefferson. He was huge devotee of the great experiment of democracy.
Right.
He wanted to come to America, at, you know, almost.
Oh, yes.
By the time he was like 10 or
right.
very young.
Oh, he was a teenager when he was reading Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson and paying attention to Washington. He grew up on the west coast of Scotland, and there was a lot of smuggling going on between the colonies and the early United States in that western portion of Scotland. Not only whiskey, I'm sure people were thinking, oh, well, whiskey, sure, but that's true, but also gunpowder and a lot of goods were going over to the U.S. that way, and the Scots also felt oppressed by England, so they sympathized with the colonists.
So he moved here. He was an American citizen, U.S. citizen.
He became an American citizen. He never considered going back.
And he never went back.
No, he left his parents, and although he sent some of his artwork back to Scotland, so I've been to Scotland to look at the collection that his parents had, but he never himself went back. So, and in fact, his sister and her children came to the U.S. partly at his urging.
Was he a success? Was he able to, or was he one of those people that became more of a success after he died? Because I know the last volume of the 9-volume series was published after his death.
After his death.
Yeah.
Right. He died in 1813, and the last volume was in process. The next to last volume was in publication, in press.
Mm-hmm.
They sold the books in those days, or Wilson was selling them by subscription.
Right.
He didn't have a patron. His whole effort was based sort of on citizens buying into the project, which they did. But the problem that created was that he was owed the money only after he delivered the books.
Okay.
So the money lagged behind the books. I'm explaining that because when he died, he was owed $30,000, which in 1813 was a huge sum. And he willed that to the woman that he was planning to marry, but did not live long enough to do that. That would have made her a fairly wealthy woman. So in that sense, he succeeded. However, he never saw the money.
My guest is Edward Burt. He is co-author of a biography of Alexander Wilson. The title of the book is called Alexander Wilson, the Scot Who Founded American Ornithology. Of course, that's a study of birds. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Edward Burt. He goes by Jed. He is co-author of the book Alexander Wilson, the Scot Who Founded American Ornithology. Of course, that's the study of birds. If you have a question or comment for Jed, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Alexander Wilson's first volume of American Ornithology appeared in 1808. It became the gold standard here and in Europe. What was the standard before then? What did people look at to study birds?
Well, that's a good question. There was nothing in the United States that they could look at. Both Jefferson and Bartram, who preceded Wilson, wrote text, but they were basically just lists of birds. In Europe, there were a few people who published illustrated books about birds. Mark Catesby even published a book on the birds of North America, but it was somewhat helter-skelter, a few species and not a geographically unified area. There wasn't really very much done that was systematic. this is part of what was so new about Wilson. He went at it very systematically. Partly that was because Linnaeus had organized the naming of things by then, so he could organize around
Linnaeus. And
he
was Linnaeus. The first to use that system.
He was the first American biologist to use the Linnaean system.
Tell us about the Linnaean. It's called Linnaean taxonomy.
Right. And
or
I apologize for seeming a little bit esoteric.
It's kind of what we expect today, but back in the day, it wasn't used yet.
Right. So even your field guide, whether you use Sibley or Peterson or the National Geographic or whatever, has in it scientific names and names that are standardized according to the Linnaean system. Linnaeus was a Swedish biologist who just decided we had to organize what we were seeing in the world so we could talk about it with each other. And he proposed a system that was then adopted by biologists ultimately worldwide. Wilson carried that system that he was aware of. I'm not sure he was familiar with it, but aware of. He brought it to the United States. And even though Bartram and Jefferson had published their lists after Linnaeus got his system into the public eye, they did not use the system.
Why did Wilson think it was important? He wasn't necessarily a trained scientist. Well, he wasn't a trained scientist.
He wasn't a trained scientist.
Not at all.
I think he was just trying to figure out what to call things. It's hard for us to conceive of going out looking at birds and going, well, I wonder what on earth that is, and having no way to find out. There were no books you could go to. In fact, there were no binoculars, so just seeing it was a bit of a problem. It was a very different world, and it's a little hard to get our minds in it.
One of the things they did then that, of course, would be frowned upon now is they shot.
Oh, absolutely.
Their subjects. They would shoot them down, and sometimes they'd actually still be alive, and he would observe their behavior, that sort of thing. Not in a cruel sense, but to study them.
No, to study them. Wilson greatly regretted shooting things, and frequently in his different volumes, he comments on how sad it is that he has to shoot anything. But in order to see the bird well, in order to portray it well, he and Audubon as well had to shoot them. There were no binoculars, nothing they could do to really watch the bird and see it in detail. Now, Wilson did spend a lot of time watching and describing birds, so he apparently had very good vision. He certainly was a wonderful marksman. It's almost beyond my comprehension to think you could look up in a tree at a warbler about 4 inches long and shoot it down.
How was he trained as a marksman?
I think by poaching game
McDowell's
estate. There was no formal training. He was never a soldier or anything like that. So I think just that way. And I've held his shotgun. He carried 2 shotguns with him.
In Scotland?
They're in the U.S.
Okay.
One is at Harvard. One is at the American Museum. And they're heavy. This was not a lightweight gun, and he didn't have a telescopic sight.
What about the bullets? It seems like a warbler would blow one of those right out of... I mean, not only would it kill it, it would just decimate it.
Yes, I totally agree. And actually, if I can be allowed a side issue that will explain the situation, I have served on committees in Washington, and I was on a committee at the Smithsonian where 2 women curators at the Smithsonian, both of whom collected birds for the Smithsonian, we were having a dinner party, and they were in a corner. I was there with them since I knew both well. They were discussing what size shot to use in shotgun shells when you were going after mannequins, which are 4 or 5 inches long, and how much powder to put in, because even small shot would tear it apart if it hits with too much force.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you've got to kill it to get the specimen. And I thought, I bet these are the only 2 women in the country who are debating the details of how to load and shot and set it up for shooting small birds on a collecting trip for the Smithsonian Museum, at least. And I assume Wilson had to do much the same sort of thing. He had to pick his shot carefully and load the shells with the powder so that they didn't, as you say, just blow the thing apart. I know he didn't, because he talks about having whole birds. But
the challenges of the late 18th century ornithologist.
Right.
Yes, exactly. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Let's talk about the eclipse of Alexander Wilson's reputation by John James Audubon. I mentioned early on in the show, anyone can talk to you about Audubon,
right,
and they could probably pick an Audubon picture out of a lineup. Mm-hmm. Not so Wilson. And they did know each other. They met a couple times. They didn't necessarily have a negative relationship. It was sort of nonplus.
No.
Nothing
no,
much came of it.
They first met. Wilson was on a trip to gather information and birds.
And subscription money.
And subscription money in 1810. And on the 17th of March, he put into the Indian Queen Hotel in Louisville, Kentucky. And that's where Audubon and his family were staying. And he met Audubon. Audubon looked at Wilson's work. He, by then, had published two volumes of his American Ornithology. And Wilson asked to see Audubon's. He had met Audubon's, I guess you'd call him uncle-in-law, in Pittsburgh, and knew that Audubon was there and that Audubon drew art. So he asked to see the artwork and was very impressed, asked Audubon if he planned to publish it. Keep in mind, at this time, Wilson is 44, Audubon is 25. And Audubon said he had no particular plans, and Wilson said, well, you should think about that. And it took Audubon 9 more years to work himself out of business with Rozier. But then Audubon started working seriously on his artwork and publishing, and, of course, the rest we know. I think it eclipsed Wilson because Audubon was is a very fine artist. His paintings are fine art. Wilson's interest was very different. He was trying to portray birds so that you could identify them. He was not a trained artist. In fact, as far as I have been able to determine, he started learning to draw and paint birds in 1803, and 10 years later he died. So
I have to say, if he was self-taught, how good would he have been?
Oh, amazing.
I
can only think that the fact that he was a trained weaver and therefore used to creating patterns and designs had to figure into all of this. But his drawings are incredibly accurate. One of his colorists, at that time in history, you printed a plate of what would be a picture, and then somebody had to hand color it. And Wilson did a lot of that himself, but he also had colorists. One of them was Robert Leslie, who became a court painter for Queen Victoria later. And in his memoirs, he recounts how Wilson would count the scales on the legs of birds to be sure that he got it right. And you look at some of the sketches in the book where you can see the scales. It's phenomenal. They're so accurate compared to William Bartram, for example, whose legs of birds were two parallel lines with a few cross lines to indicate that there were scales there.
And there were legs.
Yeah, and there were legs. And Wilson's, holy smoke, the claws on the red-tailed hawk, you wouldn't want to tangle with that foot.
No, his were considered more anatomically precise, correct, than even Audubon's some cases.
Much more so.
Why do you think that was?
Well, I think that was his concern. I mean, Audubon was an artist. He wanted a flowing picture that was balanced, that was beautiful, and he accomplished that. Obviously, people love it.
We remember him.
We remember him. Unfortunately, Wilson's friend who promoted him, George Ord, in essence, discouraged us from learning about Wilson because Ord was so opposed to Audubon as a competitor to Wilson that he forced Audubon to publish in Europe, and Audubon became very unhappy with the situation surrounding Wilson and kind of ignored him from then on. And that, I think, has perpetuated itself.
When did Wilson was self-taught as an artist? And he was self-taught as a scientist. How did he learn the science of the study of birds? How did he take it from an interest to obviously something from a gifted, probably at a very early age. How did he find that path?
Well, that's a very good question. I would have to assume he must have been extremely intelligent and curious. What Wilson does that nobody had done before is he would look at the bird, he would dissect the bird, he would see how its structures worked, and he would speculate on what that might mean. But then he would go and test the idea. And that's where he really introduces science into biology.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. The Mississippi kite, which was a species that he discovered, is a hawk. It looks like a hawk in all aspects. It's got a hooked bill and sharp talons. In fact, when Wilson was trying to pick one up that he had shot and wounded, it grabbed his wrist and the claws went right through his wrist. He had to cut the tendon to get the bird to release its grip. But he, despite how fierce the bird was, he suspected that they caught large beetles flying at high altitudes. So we go back to one of your earlier points. He went out and he shot several more of them and dissected them to see what they were eating. And in fact, they were eating large beetles. Their stomachs and gut were full of these large beetles. So he puts that into his species account. And that's an example of testing things.
So it was more than just the pictures, of course. He really advanced the knowledge.
Oh, he did. He did. For one thing, he introduced quantification. His most famous quantification is estimating a flock of passenger pigeons, which flew over him for more than 4 hours. And I can't off
the
top of my head.
This is, of course, back in the day.
This is back in the day. But he quantifies exactly how he calculated the number of birds, which was over 2 billion in the flock. Most scientists consider his estimates are very conservative, so the flock was probably much larger than he estimates. But the point is that you can recreate exactly what he did because he's very precise and puts it into the book. But that wasn't the only thing. For example, he took apart a orchard oriole nest. He was so amazed at how tightly they wove the nest, he actually undid one strand of grass and found that it was 13 inches long, and over its 13-inch length, it had been woven in and out of the nest 14 times, that the bird had actually taken and sewed it around.
And that's something he really knows about.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's not an estimate. That was a count.
Right.
But that's just an example of how detailed and careful he was. And it makes the reading of it really quite charming. He really is getting into the character, the behavior, and so forth of the birds.
European scientists who, right from the very first volume, were extremely impressed.
Yes. Well, partly because ornithology in Europe was a matter of shooting the bird, figuring out what it was related to, giving it a name, and putting it in a museum. The lists were really pretty much that, lists with some anatomy. They did not watch birds, and Wilson was advocating very strongly that we needed to go out and watch birds. In fact, this may be Bartram's influence in part, but Wilson very much appreciated the wonder of the natural world, and he writes about it as, it's just wonderful. I just can't believe they do this or they do that. And so I think that fed into an American consciousness of nature that expressed itself with Emerson and Thoreau and on down into our century, Lauren Isley and others who have written that way. It's very different writing from Europe. And that's probably the poet in him.
Yes.
Coming through. And certainly some of the American ornithology, it may be good science, but it's also beautifully written.
Exactly. I was thinking the writer in him, the poet in him.
Oh,
not just the writer, but
right.
He was a poet. He was a published poet by the age of 24,
poet.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and he published one poem, a ballad, Watty and Meg, which sold fantastically well. It was done anonymously to pay back his printer because he lost money on the two books of poetry. And it paid the printer back and then some. But Robert Burns was asked about, had he written the poem? And his answer was, no, but I wish I had.
That's not bad.
That's not a bad compliment.
We're going to continue our conversation with Edward Burt Jr. He's co-author of a new book. It's called Alexander Wilson, The Scot Who Founded American Ornithology. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. You could email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Edward Burt Jr. He is co-author of a new book. It's called Alexander Wilson, The Scot Who Founded American Ornithology. Of course, ornithology is the study of birds. Ohio Wesleyan University, where Edward is a zoology professor, will celebrate Alexander Wilson's life coming up next month. For more information on that, you can go to the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Edward Burt, who is called Jed, by the way, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Audubon's legacy is obvious. There's these Audubon societies. Apparently, there's a Wilson Society, too, now that you've told me about. It's a de rigueur if you're an ornithologist. You wrote that one of Wilson's legacies was Audubon's success. And we talked a little bit about their intersection, but how was Audubon's success a legacy of Alexander Wilson?
Well, again, Audubon certainly succeeded because he was a wonderful artist. But when he met Wilson in March of 1810, Audubon was a shopkeeper, and he had sketches of birds, which he showed to Wilson. Wilson was surprised when he asked Audubon, was he going to publish them? And Audubon said, no, he hadn't thought at all about that. And Wilson said, well, you ought to think about that.
So it was that simple suggestion. And then another interesting thing you were talking about before we stopped for a moment was his love of nature and his love of just being out there and doing what he did, the observation part of it. He was... His books were big and bulky. They were not field guides, but they are sort of the germ or the mm-hmm. seed that became
yes.
what we think of as, say, Roger Torrey Peterson's field guide
right.
or any of them.
Right. Wilson's books, like Audubon's, they were smaller than Audubon's, but still, as you say, quite large. He did have plans to come out with a pocket size version of the books that would have just black and white, probably woodcuts.
Which would have been sort of hugely groundbreaking.
Yes, it would have been. But what he was doing, and you're right, this does sort of foreshadow Peterson. Wilson was putting the birds mostly in profile so you could see all of the features, and he did put similar species together, such as on the cover of the book, there's a print from one of his books where he has a canvas back and a redhead next to each other, both turned so that the heads are facing the same direction. Nothing like that had ever been done before. And it's easy for us to look back and say, well, that's kind of primitive. But the thing is, that was the first time it had been done. It was Wilson doing it. So this is quite different. I have actually at one point taken Peterson's Pileated woodpecker, the great big woody woodpecker type mm-hmm. woodpecker, and put Peterson's picture next to Wilson's picture, and they're almost exactly the same. I'm not accusing Peterson of anything. I'm just saying that what Wilson did is what Peterson was doing also, just trying to show you how you identify it. And we weren't worried about, is it three-dimensional? and so forth. Let's get the field marks out there.
By the way, if you're listening and you want to know what we're talking about, there is a picture of the cover of the book, Alexander Wilson, the Scot Who Founded American Ornithology. It's on our website at WOSU.org/outside, so you can get a little bit of an idea about what we're talking about as far as his art goes. Jerry in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning. Great show. This is the first time I've heard an ornithologist on the radio mention Carl Linnaeus. And I've been an amateur, very amateur, bird watcher all of my 80-some years. Seen the Kirtland's warbler up at Mayo, Michigan, when the a population at that time was about 500. And I've seen the key bird on Midway Island in the Pacific. And I've watched many of my favorite bird, which is the Gavia immer, the common loon, or in Europe they call it the great northern diver. Beautiful bird. Mm-hmm. And I never heard of this Alexander Wilson.
See, there you go.
Well, now you have.
you're never too old to learn more.
Right.
They say you can't teach an old dog new tricks, but I take exception with that. Great show.
Thanks, Jerry. Thanks for the call. Wilson has had more species named after him than any other American bird expert.
That's right.
Bottom line. But that's only one measure of his stature. How else? Well, for once, how many species are named after him? And
well, there are only five.
Okay, but that's still more.
Yes, that's more. Audubon has two named after him.
And what are the five?
I'd be happy if somebody would name one after
There's the Wilson Warbler.
There's Wilson's Warbler.
Warbler, right. That's right.
This is a test for me. Wilson's Warbler, Wilson's Phalarope, Wilson's Plover, Wilson's Snipe, and Wilson's Storm Petrel.
And those all go back to Alexander Wilson, the man we're talking about today.
They were all named by other people, but based on Wilson's descriptions.
He taught himself, well... How else do you measure besides
his success? Well, he started a number of trends in ornithology. For example, he started economic ornithology in that he wrote about birds that eat grain or eat fruit and pointed out that they're also eating insects. And what we need to do is carefully study them so that we get some sense of are they causing more problem than benefit, or are they causing more benefit than they're causing damage? And he's realistic about this. His point about the red-headed woodpecker, which had bounties on it in his day, was that it's eating insects that are boring into fruit trees and killing the fruit trees. So the amount of fruit it eats is really only a down payment on the damage that it's preventing. But the bobolink, it eats rice, huge amounts of rice. It migrates into the rice area of the South just at the time the rice is coming in, and he couldn't see anything that could be done except to shoot them to keep them off the rice until it was harvested.
Interesting. With the Pileated, was that the bird that he had chained to his table?
And yes. There's the great story. It's not the Pileated. It was an ivy-billed woodpecker.
Okay.
Yes. Good old Wilson. He lives back before all these extinctions. But he had shot three ivy-billed woodpeckers in North Carolina. One of them he just injured. That's the one that he actually paints for his book. But he went to the hotel where he was going to stay. He turned the ivory bill. Now you've got me doing it.
Sorry.
The ivory bill woodpecker loose in the room and went to get dinner and for him and the woodpecker. And when he came back, the woodpecker was within one layer of wall of being able to cut itself out of the room. So he then tied it to the table leg and went back to get things for it to eat. When he came back, the woodpecker had taken the mahogany table leg off the table, but couldn't get itself off the leg, so it couldn't get around the room very well. Ultimately, the bird died. He would not eat, and despite everything Wilson did, he couldn't get it to eat. But it was the one that he painted and checked the anatomy and so forth.
Fierce.
But
absolutely fierce is the images that that conjured for me.
I'd like to know what he paid the innkeeper.
I'm sure damages were due at the checkout time.
Yeah, I suspect.
It's even more amazing, everything that he did, his art and everything, because it was based on his own discoveries.
Yes.
He didn't have anything to copy.
Oh, that's true. He had nothing to copy, but he did. One of his innovations was to set up what we now call citizen science. Everywhere he went, everybody he met, he enlisted to help him.
Now there's the big count day.
Right.
Which we take for granted.
Right. There's the Christmas count, but Wilson did the first breeding bird survey, and it's published in American Ornithology.
And what was that?
Well, during the breeding season, National Audubon sponsors studies that are done over a number of weeks where you count the birds that are breeding in a particular area and try to work out what's the breeding population, as opposed to one day where you just go out and count everything
okay.
you can see. I did those as a teenager, actually. I did two breeding bird surveys. But Wilson did the first one. So a number of these sorts of things that he really kind of got started.
And he recruited people to collect specimens. There was the railroad operation that the railroaders, or?
He certainly got, yes, he published the first recipe for how to put up a bird. You know, once you shoot it, the problem he had, which again is one of these name problems, different parts of the country called the same bird different things. So he'd get something back from somebody who lived, say, in Louisiana, and it would be given a name that he would not know, and he wouldn't know what the bird was we were talking about. So he encouraged people to send him careful descriptions or even the birds. Well, one can imagine he opened a package one day and there was this rotting bird in it.
Oh.
So in volume two, he publishes a recipe for how to skin the bird and prepare it so that it won't rot. And this is the first time that was done formally. All of his specimens were then deposited with the Peale Museum in Philadelphia, which was open to the public, so he was concerned about depositing them. And some of them still exist.
I was going to say, because Peale doesn't.
No, the Peale Museum went bankrupt in the mid-1800s, but Wilson's specimens were sent to Harvard, some, I believe, to the American Museum in New York.
I'm talking with Jed Burt, Edward Burt Jr. He is co-author of Alexander Wilson, the Scot Who Founded American Ornithology. Of course, that's a study of birds. If you have a question or comment, we still have a few minutes left. 614-292-8513. Email from Rich, who underscores your point. Of course, a number of birds are named for Wilson. For example, Wilson's warbler, Wilson's phalarope.
Yes.
But Wilson first described many of our birds, including those from the Lewis and Clark expedition. There is an interesting story about his friendship with Meriwether Lewis.
Well, yes, he and Meriwether Lewis were friends. And Meriwether Lewis was appointed governor of the Louisiana Territory by Thomas Jefferson and then died at Grinders Ferry, I believe it was. And Wilson, on his way west in 1810, stopped at Grinders and tried to figure out whether Meriwether Lewis had committed suicide or been murdered. He did not figure it out, but he did publish a full report of his findings. So that was sort of his final contact with Meriwether Lewis. But they were friends, and Lewis brought three specimens back for Wilson: Lewis's woodpecker, Clark's nutcracker, and what Wilson named the Louisiana tanager, which we now know as the Western tanager. Names change.
I was surprised. Well, most of his drawings are the drawings in the book. These are being published for the first time.
Many of them are. These are his sketches, and many of them are labeled in Wilson's own handwriting. He would sketch in the field and indicate color. So they're a lot of things that are there and seen for the first time publicly anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there was a question earlier about Wilson's age.
Yes.
When he died.
Yeah, young.
He died rather young. He was 47 when he died. And he supposedly has died of dysentery, but I would say that in part it was just exhaustion. He had, in the 2 years preceding his death, he had written, he had researched, he had illustrated, he had written, edited, and published 5 volumes of the American Ornithology, which is a phenomenal production rate. So
why do you
tired.
Think the sense of urgency for him?
I don't know.
Unless did he ever write about what his goals
actually,
were?
Actually, no. I take that back. A lot of that was economics. We were entering the War of 1812. The British had the French and the Americans blockaded. And so the economic situation was very difficult. Wilson was running out of money because subscribers paid when they got the book, but not before. And his publisher wanted money before publishing books. So he was in quite a bind there. He actually had to get rid of all his colorists and do all the coloring himself. So he colored somewhere in the neighborhood of 20,000 birds, many of them the same bird over and over again, but still, that's handwork to be done. So one of the things we're doing at the symposium is mounting an exhibit of all of Wilson's 76 plates, all hand-colored. I'm not going to say by Wilson, but they're all hand-colored.
That were in his
that
books.
That were in books, yeah. Yes, so we'll have, and we have some of his sketches.
You wrote about George Ord, the controversial friend of Wilson's, who became, as you put it, the self-appointed guardian of Wilson's reputation, and you referred to his earlier years as something of a hobbyist. And when I was reading about that, you know, he was into philosophy. He was wealthy, son of a wealthy person. Was bird watching or birding at all a familiar hobby? I mean, nothing's like it is today, but was it something that just the wealthy did, or how do we compare today the nature of birding and bird watching to back in the day of Alexander Wilson?
I would say, based on my reading of folks at the time, that nobody really did it. You were aware of nature in a way that we really aren't today because, of course, you lived much closer to it. But there were not, people didn't bird watch in the same sense that we think of it today. And that really is an outgrowth of Wilson and some of the Europeans who began to create lists of birds and ways to identify and recognize them. So, no, I would say George Ord was just basically an amateur at most everything he did. He had the time.
Including
managing Wilson's reputation.
He managed to insult a lot of other people.
Sort of lock the door and not let anybody else in. He was Wilson's friend and nobody else could be.
Well, your book certainly unlocks the door. It's called Alexander Wilson, the Scot Who Founded American Ornithology. I've been talking with Edward Burt Jr., co-author with William Davis Jr. of the book. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Again, if you want to know more about the symposium on Alexander Wilson, you can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Morning.